Good evening, Los Angeles, and welcome to The Talking Show on K Chung Radio, Chinatown's only micro-broadcasting radio station. My name is Nicholas Miller, and I am here, as always, with Stephen Cato.
Hi, Nick. How are you? Hello to everyone out there in the audience. Woo!
Steve and I have taken to jogging to the K-Chung Studios together, which has been quite a thrill for me because Steve's a much better runner than I am. But, you know, I'm holding my own, wouldn't you say, Steve?
Yeah, you're not doing so badly. I mean, it's one of those things where once you get going, you know, you can just build on that step at a time, you know? Yeah.
Well, we want to thank everyone who stuck in there last episode. Where we said farewell to one of our great influences, Robert Ashley.
Yeah.
Rest in peace, Bob.
Yeah.
So while Robert Ashley represents for us one of the more obscure forms of talking that we have here on our show, tonight we're going to deal with a type of talking that is a bit more endemic in our society.
Uh-huh.
And our guest tonight is going to take head on a number of topics, but most importantly for tonight is going to deal with...
Spit it out. You seem a little hesitant there.
With the TED Talk.
That's right.
For those of you, I'm sure most of you are familiar with the TED Talk.
Ew.
But for those of you who aren't, it is a kind of... forum where innovators and thinkers are invited to come discuss technology, entertainment, or design, which is where TED comes from.
Ugh.
And these talks are all recorded, and then there's a massive infrastructure for distributing the videos and audio over the internet, so that you can, from anywhere and any point, as long as you have internet access, once again, become a student. Isn't that right, Steve? Steve.
Yeah, hi, sorry.
Steve, seriously, get off your phone and help host our show. Sorry, everyone. Steve gets a little wrapped up in his communication technologies. So tonight, our speaker this evening is the thinker, media philosopher, whatever you would like to call him, but overall extraordinary, Benjamin Bratton.
The guy who lives backwards?
No, Steve. not Benjamin Button. Come on.
All right. I wasn't paying attention.
Benjamin Bratton from the University of California, San Diego. Everyone, sit up straight. This is going to be a very serious talk dealing with issues that affect all of us. Once again, we have here on The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio, Benjamin Bratton.
In our culture, talking about the future is sometimes a polite way of saying things about the present that would otherwise be rude or risky. But have you ever wondered why so little of the bright futures promised in TED Talks actually come true? Is it something wrong with the ideas or with the notion of what ideas can do all by themselves? I write about the entanglements of technology and culture, how technologies make certain composition of certain worlds possible, how culture in turn structures the evolution of those technologies. It's where philosophy and design intersect. And so, the conceptualization of possibilities is something that I take very seriously, and it's for that reason that I and a lot of people think that it's time that we take a step back and ask some serious questions about the intellectual viability of things like TED. And so my TED Talk is not about my work, my new book, the usual spiel. It's about TED, what it is and why it doesn't work. The first reason is oversimplification. Now, to be clear, I have nothing against the idea of interesting people who do smart things, explaining their work in a way that everyone can understand. But TED goes way beyond that. Let me tell you a story. I was recently at a presentation that a friend of mine, an astrophysicist, was making to a potential donor. And I thought this talk was lucid, it was engaging, and I'm a professor of visual arts here at UC San Diego. At the end of the day, I know nothing about astrophysics. The donor, however, said, you know what, I'm going to pass. I'm just not inspired. You should be more like Malcolm Gladwell. Now, at this point, I kind of lost it. Can you imagine? I mean, think about it. A scientist who creates real knowledge should be more like a journalist who recycles fake insights. This is not popularization. This is taking something with substance and value and coring it out so that it can be swallowed without chewing. This is not how we'll confront our most frightening problems. This is one of our most frightening problems. And so, so what is TED? TED is perhaps a proposition, one that says if we talk about world-changing ideas enough, then the world will change. Well, this is not true either, and that's the second problem. TED, of course, stands for Technology, Entertainment, Design. To me, TED stands for Middlebrow Megachurch Infotainment. The key rhetorical device of any TED talk is a combination of epiphany and personal testimony. The speaker shares some personal story of insight and revelation, its trials and tribulations. What does the TED audience hope to get from this? Vicarious insight, a fleeting moment of wonder, a sense that maybe it's all going to work out after all, spiritual buzz? Well, I'm sorry, but this is not up to the challenge of the problems that we are ostensibly here to face. They are complex and difficult and not given to tidy, just-so solutions. They don't care about anyone's experience of optimism. And given the stakes, having our best and brightest waste their time and the audience's time, dancing about like infomercial hosts, is too high a price. And it's cynical. Plus, it just doesn't work. Recently, TED Global sent out a memo to TEDx local organizers telling them to avoid booking speakers whose work spans the paranormal, conspiratorial, new age, quantum neuroenergy and so forth, what is called woo. Instead, they should book speakers whose work is imaginative but grounded in reality. And to be fair, TED Global took some heat for this, so the gesture should be acknowledged. No to placebo science and placebo medicine. But the corollary to placebo science and medicine is placebo politics and placebo innovation. And on this count, TED has a ways to go. Perhaps the pinnacle of placebo politics was presented at TEDx San Diego a few years ago. You're familiar, I assume, with the Kony 2012 social media campaign? Okay, so what happened here? Evangelical surfer bro goes to Africa. He makes campy video explaining genocide to the cast of Glee. The world finds his epiphany to be shallow to the point of self-delusion. The complex geopolitics of Central Africa are left undisturbed. Kony's still there, the end. You see, when inspiration becomes manipulation, inspiration becomes obfuscation. And if you're not cynical, you should be skeptical. You should be as skeptical of placebo politics as you are of placebo medicine. So, TED. First, technology. We're told that not only is change accelerating, but the pace of change is accelerating. And in terms of the computational carrying capacity at a planetary level, this is true. But at the same time, and in fact the two are related, we're also in a moment of cultural deacceleration. We invest our energies in futuristic information technologies, including our cars, but drive them home to kitsch architecture copied from the 18th century. The future on offer is one in which everything can change so long as everything stays the same. We'll have Google Glass, but we'll still have business casual. This timidity is not our path to the future. This is incredibly conservative. And more gigaflops won't inoculate us, because if a problem is endemic to a system, then the exponential effects of Moore's law also amplify what's broken. It's more computation along the wrong curve. And I hardly think this is a triumph of reason. A lot of my work deals with deep technocultural shifts from the post-humanism to the post-anthropocene. But the TED version has too much faith in technology and not enough commitment to technology. It's placebo techno-radicalism, toying with risk so as to reaffirm the comfortable. And so, our machines get smarter and we get stupider. But it doesn't have to be that way. Both can be much more intelligent. Another futurism is possible. A better E in TED might stand for economics. And yes, imagining and designing new systems of valuation and exchange, of accounting for transaction externalities, of financing coordinated planning, and so on, because states and markets, states versus markets, these are insufficient models. Our thinking is stuck in a Cold War gear. And worse is when economics is debated like metaphysics, as if any real system is just a bad example of the ideal. Communism in theory was an egalitarian utopia. Actually existing communism meant ecological devastation, government spying, crappy cars, gulags. Capitalism in theory is rocket ships, nanomedicine, Bono saving Africa. Actually existing capitalism is Walmart jobs, McMansions, people living in sewers under Las Vegas, Ryan Seacrest, plus ecological devastation, government spying, crappy public transportation, and for-profit prisons. And yet, the alternatives on offer range from basically what we have plus a little more Hayek to what we have plus a little more Keynes. Why? The recent centuries have seen tremendous advances in improving the quality of life. But the paradox is that the system we have now, whatever you want to call it, is in the short term what makes these new technologies possible, but in the long term, it's also what suppresses their full flowering. A new economic architecture is prerequisite. So D for design. Perhaps our designers, instead of prototyping the same change agent for good projects over and over again, and then wondering why they aren't implemented at scale, we should acknowledge that design is not some magic answer. Design is very important, but for different reasons. Getting excited about design is easy because, like talking about the future, it's more polite than dealing with the real white elephants in the room, such as phones, drones, and genomes. That's what we do here in San Diego and La Jolla. And in addition to all of the amazingly great things that these technologies do, they are also the basis of NSA spying, flying robots killing people, and the wholesale privatization of biological life. That's also what we do. So you see, the potential of these technologies is both wonderful and horrifying at the same time. And so to guide them towards a good future, design as innovation just isn't strong enough of an idea by itself. We need to talk a lot more about design as immunization, actively preventing certain innovations that we don't want from happening. So as for one clear takeaway, one magic idea, I don't really have one. That's kind of the point. Perhaps I might venture that if our species were actually to solve its most dire problems, perhaps a lot of us in this room would be out of a job, or at least, or perhaps in jail. But it's not as though we don't have a lot of really important things to be talking about. We need a deeper discussion about the difference between digital cosmopolitanism and cloud feudalism. And towards that, a queer history of computer science, Alan Turing's birthday as a holiday. I would like new maps of the world, ones not based on settler colonialism, legacy genomes, and Bronze Age myths, but something more scalable. But TED today is not that. Our problems are not puzzles to be solved. This metaphor implies that all the necessary pieces are already on the table. They just need to be rearranged and reprogrammed. It's not true. Innovation defined as puzzles, as rearranging pieces and adding more processing power, is not some big idea that's going to disrupt the broken status quo. That precisely is the broken status quo. One TED speaker said recently about his work, "Now that this boundary is removed, the only boundary left is our imagination." Wrong. If we really want transformation, we have to slog through the hard stuff, the history, the economics, philosophy, art, the ambiguities and contradictions. Because focusing just on technology or just on innovation actually prevents transformation. We need to raise the level of general understanding to the level of complexity of the systems in which we are embedded and which are embedded in us. And this is not about personal stories of inspiration. It's about the hard, difficult work of demystification and reconceptualization. More Copernicus, less Tony Robbins. At a societal level, the bottom line is that if we invest in things that make us feel good but which don't work, and don't invest in things which don't make us feel good but which may solve problems, then our fate is that in the long run it'll just get harder and harder to feel good about not solving problems. And in this case, the placebo is not just ineffective, it's harmful. But because it takes your interest and energy and outrage and diverts it into this black hole of affectation. Keep calm and carry on innovating. Is that the real message of TED? To me, it's not inspirational, it's cynical. In the US, the right wing has certain media channels that allow it to bracket reality. Other constituencies have TED. Thank you for your time.
Wow. Thank you, Benjamin.
Yeah, thank you. That was great.
Wow. Ew. So what do you think about that, Steve?
I thought it was great. I mean, it was extremely creepy and gross, but really cut to the heart of why Ted is so terrifying. You know, it was sort of like the meta Ted talk, if you will. I really like how he even worked in that stuff where, you know, he makes a short, snappy, brief point and then follows that up after like one beat by saying, let me tell you a story about that. You know, that happens in every single TED talk, and you just feel like the brain cells, the neurons stop firing, and like the sort of Garrison Keillor engine just starts spinning up or something like that. Do you know what I'm saying? Like the bad talking? It was great. Yeah.
You know, something a friend said to me the other day that I've been puzzling over is that, you know, the internet promised this virtual world, this world where you could be anything, anything that could be imagined could happen. But for whatever reason, I feel like we find ourselves in a place where it is not a place of imagination. It's a place where everyone just exposes the details and particulars of their life. They try to make them their supposed real life as present as possible on the internet, and it no longer is a place where, you know, the place where I used to play that game Mud. Did you ever play Mud where you're that what is it called? It's like a key entry kind of video game.
Yeah. I remember those games really fondly. You'd play them on the BBS with your nerd friends in other parts of the world, and it was a world of imagination. I remember the early internet really well, and I agree with you. I really miss the old future. You know, there was this talk early on about what cyberspace would be like, and they would use these examples of there being games where you could be all these different things. And then do you remember when everyone was obsessed with Second Life? Like that was where the internet and cultural commentators met, and they would talk about Second Life endlessly, because you could be, you know, anything. Men could be women, they could have wings, it could be whatever. It was like Burning Man but in computers or something, I guess. It never really appealed to me because I've always had a hard enough time with myself to really waste time imagining myself different. Like I find the facts themselves of my existence here in late capitalism so puzzling that I can't possibly explain them to myself, let alone I can't imagine my life actually. So, you know, imagining something totally different seems like a waste of time to me. That's a good way of putting it. But all that happens is people put pictures of like the food that exists, right? Like when people take pictures of their food at a restaurant, they're not imagining any food and they're not imagining anything different than what exists. They are actually just reiterating that that food exists and that that is an extant reality, and that you can't eat food through the internet. That's all they're doing by putting pictures of food on the internet. So I totally agree with you. That's a great observation that that the internet's just what already is. And then with, I think, like an accent on moreness, like there's more kittens on the internet and they're so cute. And there's more pictures of food on the internet, and maybe it helps you make decisions about where you eat when you look for a place to eat on the internet, you know, because you're trying to try something new, or you're wondering where there's a good Indian restaurant and you haven't been to a good Indian restaurant yet, or what, you know. Does that make any sense? Anyway, so That's all I got to say about that. Yeah, I totally agree with you. We can see that bearing itself out in the world around us. It's gross.
Anyhow. Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know much about the deep web. Maybe that's where the imagination has gone. Into the deep web.
I don't know. I don't know anything about that either.
Where you can buy it, but only with bitcoins.
Yeah, or dog coins or whatever.
Yeah. Steve, what happened to the Bitcoin thing? I mean, that was another great technology that was, going to really open things up for us. What happened there?
I think, as far as I know, it's still working out. Like, the media frenzy has subsided, but I think Bitcoins are still good for stuff. I think they're still quite valuable. I don't know too much about Bitcoins, but who in this station does know a lot about Bitcoins is Solomon. Solomon knows, I don't know if I should say this on the air, but he knows a lot about Bitcoins. Just saying. He does. And yeah, I don't know if I should have said that, but I know. I mean, I guess the thing is that we are so far away from the edge of development here in technology, you and I, in our sort of, German intellectual tradition focused aesthetic reverie, that maybe we just have no idea. But, the way you see technology playing itself out daily in our lives, I certainly do, hanker for that utopianism that I remember from the late 80s and early 90s when I got like my first modem and all that. Does that sound?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I miss the future too, Steve.
Oh boy, do I ever.
I miss it just as much as you.
Yeah. What I'm interested in checking out, or what I learned about on the internet, speaking of the internet and food, is there, apparently in San Francisco, the trend is to now pay money to be served toast. You get toppings on your toast, but you pay money to have someone make toast. And like, you could always get toast at a diner for $1.25 or something like that, or what, a dollar, to pump up your eggs and bacon. But we're talking about like restaurants focusing on toast, which sounds to me like maybe the internet has actually made everyone into total babies. Isn't that just the grossest thing you've ever heard? Like, people who have to go out to make toast and have to go out to have like a topping applied to toast. Like, they couldn't buy toppings and apply them to toast in their own homes. I mean, also, it's clear that someone in San Francisco has figured out how to print money. And they should go for it. If there are people who cannot prepare their own toast, they've found a market for their skills at toast making, and they should go for it. I don't know. Jesus. Anyway, I'm going to go to San Francisco in the next little while, and I will let you know if it is, in fact, as messed up as I think it is. Anyway, that's all. I'm sorry, that was a long rant. I am just so puzzled and bummed out about this toast thing, And it's not even for TV. It's not even like dumb Starbucks, It's like, it's actually adults paying to have just toast.
Okay. Well, I think that's about enough for tonight. The talk wasn't our longest, but it was jam-packed with some interesting things for you to think about as you lay your pretty little heads to rest. So sleep tight. Have good dreams, wake up early, get your coffee, get to work, and innovate. This has been The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio. Good night.
We are such jerks. All right, good night, everyone. Bye.